David, I'm sorry you have kept you waiting. It's my fault. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
So, I think it's best if you introduce yourself. I know you're the chairman of MCAM, International Innovation Risk Management, but that doesn't tell a whole lot of people what you're really doing.
Yeah, well, from a corporate standpoint, we have, since 1998, been the world's largest underwriter of intangible assets used in finance in 168 countries. So in the majority of the countries around the world, our underwriting systems, which include the entire corpus of all patents, patent applications, federal grants, procurement records, e-government records, etc. We have the ability to not only track what is happening and who is involved in what's happening, but we monitor a series of thematic interests for a variety of organizations and individuals, as well as for our own commercial use, because as you probably know, we maintain three global equity indices, which are the top performing large cap and mid cap equity indexes worldwide. So our business is to monitor the innovation that's happening around the world, and specifically to monitor the economics of that innovation, the degree to which financial interests are being served, corporate interests are being dislocated, et cetera. So our business is the business of innovation and its finance.
Also seine Firma, er ist der Vorstand von MCAM International, und er, um es ganz kurz zusammenzufassen, überwacht mit oder beobachtet, besser gesagt, mit dieser Firma die Innovationen, die weltweit passieren, dazu gehören, und zwar in den und zwar so, wie sie sich ausdrücken, in den sogenannten Intangible Assets. Also das sind die, das sind zum Beispiel Patente. Patente spielen hier eine ganz große Rolle. Und er betreibt mit seiner Firma beobachtet mit seiner Firma auch die Equity Indizes, um da zu sehen, wie reagiert die Finanzindustrie auf solche Innovationen. Okay, I got that.
Yeah. So obviously, from the standpoint of this presentation, as you know, we have reviewed the over 4,000 patents that have been issued around SARS coronavirus. And we have done a very comprehensive review of the financing of all of the manipulations of coronavirus, which gave rise to SARS as a subclade of the beta coronavirus family. And so what I wanted to do was give you a quick overview timeline-wise, because we're not going to go through 4,000 patents on this conversation. But I have sent to you and your team a document that is exceptionally important. This was made public in the spring of 2020.
Yes.
This document, which you do have and can be posted in the public record, is quite critical in that we took the reported gene sequence, which was reportedly isolated as a novel coronavirus, indicated as such by the ICTV, the International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses of the World Health Organization. We took the actual genetic sequences that were reportedly novel and reviewed those against the patent records that were available as of the spring of 2020. And what we found, as you'll see in this report, are over 120 patented pieces of evidence to suggest that the declaration of a novel coronavirus was actually entirely a fallacy. There was no novel coronavirus. there are countless very subtle modifications of coronavirus sequences that have been uploaded. But there was no single identified novel coronavirus at all. As a matter of fact, we found records in the patent records of sequences attributed to novelty going to patents that were sought as early as 1999. So not only was this not a novel anything, it's actually not only not been novel, it's not been novel for over two decades. But let's take a very short and what I'll do is I'll take you on a very short journey through the patent landscape to make sure people understand what happened. But as you know, up until 1999, the topic of coronavirus vis-a-vis the patenting activity around coronavirus was uniquely applied to veterinary sciences. The first vaccine ever patented for coronavirus was actually sought by Pfizer. The application for the first vaccine for coronavirus, which was specifically this S spike protein. So the exact same thing that allegedly we have rushed into invention. The first application was filed January 28th, 2000. 21 years ago. So the idea that we mysteriously stumbled on the way to intervene on vaccines is not only ludicrous, it is incredulous. Because Timothy Miller, Sharon Klepfer, Albert Paul Reed, and Elaine Jones on January 28th, 2000, filed what ultimately was issued as U.S. Patent 6372224, which was the spike protein virus vaccine for the canine coronavirus, which is actually one of the multiple forms of coronavirus. But as I said, the early work up until 1999 was largely focused in the area of vaccines for animals. The two animals receiving the most attention were probably Ralph Baric's work on rabbits and the rabbit cardiomyopathy that was associated with significant problems among rabbit breeders, and then canine coronavirus in Pfizer's work to identify how to develop S and spike protein vaccine target candidates, giving rise to the obvious evidence that says that neither the coronavirus concept of a vaccine nor the principle of the coronavirus itself as a pathogen of interest with respect to the spike protein's behavior is anything novel at all. As a matter of fact, it's 22 years old based on patent filings. What's more problematic, and what is actually the most egregious problem, is that Anthony Fauci and NIAID found the malleability of coronavirus to be a potential candidate for HIV vaccines. And so SARS is actually not a natural progression of a zoonotic modification of coronavirus. As a matter of fact, very specifically, in 1999, Anthony Fauci funded research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, specifically to create, and you cannot help but you know, lament what I'm about to read, because this comes directly from a patent application filed on April 19th, 2002. And you heard the date correctly, 2002, where the NIAID built an infectious replication defective coronavirus that was specifically targeted for human lung epithelium. In other words, we made SARS. patented it on April 19th, 2002, before there was ever any alleged outbreak in Asia, which, as you know, followed that by several months. That patent, issued as U.S. Patent 7279327, that patent clearly lays out in very specific gene sequencing the fact that we knew that the ACE receptor, the ACE2 binding domain, the S1 spike protein, and other elements of what we have come to know as this scourge pathogen was not only engineered, but could be synthetically modified in the laboratory using nothing more than gene sequencing technologies, taking computer code and turning it into a pathogen or an intermediate of the pathogen. And that technology was funded exclusively in the early days as a means by which we could actually harness coronavirus as a vector to distribute HIV vaccine. I'll let you translate that because that's a lot of material.
Okay. David hat eben erklärt, dass es über 4000 Patente um das SARS-Coronavirus gibt. Das hat seine Firma, die hat seine Firma sich alle genau angesehen. Über 4000 Patente, auch die Finanzierung, die darum herum eine Rolle spielen. Die Idee, dass wir es hier mit einem neuen, mit einer neuen Sequenz des Coronavirus zu tun haben, überhaupt mit einem neuen Coronavirus, die ist falsch. Es gibt 120 Patentbeweismittel dafür, dass das nicht stimmt. Es ist kein neues Coronavirus. Es gibt höchstens ein paar Varianten, aber das Coronavirus selbst ist überhaupt nichts Neues. Die Idee, dagegen zu impfen, auch nicht. Seit zwei Jahrzehnten, seit 1999, wird damit gearbeitet. Bis 1999, also Forschung am Menschen, bis 1999 betraf die Corona-Forschung allerdings so gut wie ausschließlich Tiermedizin. Die Tiermedizin, der erste Impfstoff kam von Pfizer, der ein S, also ein Spike-Protein, produziert. Hat. Das wurde patentiert am 28. Januar 2000, also vor 21 Jahren. Er hat sogar die Patentnummer gesagt, US Patent Nummer 6372224. Und das war ein Impfstoff für Hunde, Canines. Es ist also nicht nur lächerlich, sondern grober Unfug, wenn gesagt wird, dass das hier alles neu ist. Weder das Virus ist neu, noch die Idee, noch der Impfstoff ist neu. Es gibt zwei große Bemühungen für solche Impfstoffe, die beide was mit Tieren zu tun haben. Einmal von Ralph Baric, das ist einer der wichtigsten Personen hier. Wir wollen mal gucken, ob wir mit ihm ins Gespräch kommen können. An Kaninchen und einmal die Pfizer-Bemühungen, die sich um Hunde und die Entwicklung des S-Spike-Protein-Impfstoffs für Hunde gekümmert hat. Also weder Corona noch der Impfstoff ist irgendetwas Neues. Im Gegenteil, Anthony Fauci vom NIAID, das ist das National, ich will es jetzt nicht ganz und gar falsch sagen, das National,
National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Yes, thank you. Der hat ein Patent auf, also er hat Forschung finanziert im Jahre 2002, die sich damit befasst hat, ein infektiöses, replikationsfähiges Coronavirus, also ein gefährliches Coronavirus zu schaffen. Er sagt ganz einfach, darauf hat Fauci damals ein Patent bekommen, am 19. April 2002. Und David sagt, we made SARS. Wir haben das, was wir hier haben, selber produziert. und es ist damals patentiert worden. Bevor es irgendeinen SARS-Ausbruch gegeben hat. Wir erinnern uns, 2003 gab es das erste Mal einen SARS-Ausbruch und da war der Kollaborateur, kann man inzwischen sagen, aufgrund der offengelegten E-Mails von Anthony Fauci, Drosten, auch dabei. Übrigens auch bei den Gain-of-Function-Experimenten, also bei diesen Experimenten, die die Viren gefährlicher machen sollen. Diese Technologie wurde damals gefunden oder erfunden als Träger für HIV-Impfungen. Okay.
Okay. So it gets worse.
Uh-oh.
my organization was asked to monitor biological and chemical weapons treaty violations in the very early days of 2000. You'll remember the anthrax events in September of 2001. And we were part of an investigation that gave rise to the congressional inquiry into not only the anthrax origins, but also into what was unusual behavior around Bayer's ciprofloxacin drug, which was a drug used as a potential treatment for anthrax poisoning. And throughout the fall of 2001, we began monitoring an enormous number of bacterial and viral pathogens that were being patented through NIH, NIAID, U.S. AMRID, the U.S. Armed Services Infectious Disease Program, and a number of other agencies internationally that collaborated with them. And our concern was that coronavirus was being seen as not only a potential manipulatable agent for potential use as a vaccine vector, but it was also very clearly being considered as a biological weapon candidate. And so our first public reporting on this took place prior to the SARS outbreak in the latter part of 2001. So you can imagine how disappointed I am to be sitting here 20 years later, having 20 years earlier pointed that there was a problem looming on the horizon with respect to coronavirus. But after the alleged outbreak, and I will always say alleged outbreak because I think it's important for us to understand that coronavirus as a circulating pathogen inside of the viral model that we have is actually not new to the human condition and is not new to the last two decades. It's actually been part of the sequence of proteins that circulates for quite a long time. But the alleged outbreak that took place in China in 2002 going into 2003 gave rise to a very problematic April 2003 filing by the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And this topic is of critical importance to get the nuance very precise. Because in addition to filing the entire gene sequence on what became SARS coronavirus, which is actually a violation of 35 U.S. Code Section 101, you cannot patent a naturally occurring substance. The 35 U.S. Code Section 101 violation was patent number 7220852. Now, that patent also had a series of derivative patents associated with it. These are patent applications that were broken apart because they were of multiple patentable subject matter. But these include U.S. Patent 4659-2703P, which is actually a very interesting designation. U.S. Patent 776521, that is 776521. These patents not only covered the gene sequence of SARS coronavirus, but also covered the means of detecting it, using RT-PCR. Now, the reason why that's a problem is if you actually both own the patent on the gene itself and you own the patent on its detection, you have a cunning advantage to being able to control 100% of the provenance of not only the virus itself, but also its detection, meaning you have entire scientific and message control. And this patent, sought by the CDC, was allegedly justified by their public relations team as being sought so that everyone would be free to be able to research coronavirus. The only problem with that statement is it's a lie. Huh. And the reason why it's a lie is because the patent office not once but twice rejected the patent on the gene sequence as unpatentable because the gene sequence was already in the public domain. In other words, prior to CDC's filing for a patent, the patent office found 99.9% identity with the already existing coronavirus recorded in the public domain. And over the rejection of the patent examiner, and after having to pay an appeal fine in 2006 and 2007, the CDC overrode the patent office's rejection of their patent and ultimately in 2007 got the patent on SARS coronavirus. Wow. So every public statement that CDC has made that said that this was in the public interest is falsifiable by their own paid bribe to the patent office. This is not something that's subtle, and to make matters worse, they paid an additional fee to keep their application private. Last time I checked, if you're trying to make information available for the public research, you would not pay a fee to keep the information private. I wish I could have made up anything I just said, but all of that is available in the public patent archive record, which any member of the public can review. And the public pair, as it's called at the United States Patent Office, has not only the evidence, but the actual documents, which I have in my possession. Now, this is critically important. It's critically important because fact checkers have repeatedly stated that the novel coronavirus, designated as SARS-CoV-2, is in fact distinct from the CDC patent. And here's both the genetic and the patent problem. If you look at the gene sequence that is filed by CDC in 2003, again in 2005, and then again in 2006, what you find is identity in somewhere between 89 to 99% of the sequence overlaps that have been identified in what's called the novel subclade of SARS-CoV-2. What we know is that the core designation of SARS coronavirus, which is actually the clade of the beta coronavirus family, and the subclade that has been called SARS-CoV-2 have to overlap from a taxonomic point of view. You cannot have SARS designation on a thing without it first being SARS. So the disingenuous fact-checking that has been done saying that somehow or another CDC has nothing to do with this particular patent or this particular pathogen is beyond both the literal credibility of the published sequences, and it's also beyond credulity when it comes to the ICTV taxonomy, because it very clearly states that this is in fact a subclade of the clade called SARS coronavirus. Now, what's important is on the 28th of April, and listen to the date very carefully because this date is problematic. 3 days after CDC filed the patent on the SARS coronavirus in 2003, 3 days later, Sequoia Pharmaceuticals, a company that was set up in Maryland, Sequoia Pharmaceuticals, on the 28th of April, 2003, filed a patent on antiviral agents for treatment and control of infections by coronavirus. CDC filed 3 days earlier, and then the treatment was available 3 days later. Now, just hold that thought for a second.
Who is Sequoia Pharmaceuticals?
Well, there you go. That's a good question, because Sequoia Pharmaceuticals and ultimately Ablynx Pharmaceuticals became rolled into the proprietary holdings of Pfizer, Crucell, and Johnson & Johnson.
Wow.
So ask yourself a simple question. How would one have a patent on a treatment for a thing that had been invented 3 days earlier?
Yeah.
The patent in question, the April 28th, 2003 patent, 715-1163, issued to Sequoia Pharmaceuticals, has another problem. The problem is it was issued and published before the CDC patent on coronavirus was actually allowed. So the degree to which the information could have been known by any means other than insider information between those parties is zero. It is not physically possible for you to patent a thing that treats a thing that had not been published because CDC had paid to keep it secret. This, my friends, is the definition of criminal conspiracy, racketeering, and collusion. This is not a theory. This is evidence. You cannot have information in the future inform a treatment for a thing that did not exist.
This could well blow up into a RICO case ultimately.
This is it is a RICO case. It's not could blow up into it. It is a RICO case. And the RICO pattern, which was established in April of 2003 for the first coronavirus, was played out to exactly the same schedule when we see SARS-CoV-2 show up, when we have Moderna getting the spike protein sequence by phone from the Vaccine Research Center at NIAID prior to the definition of the novel subclade. How do you treat a thing before you actually have the thing?
I have to translate this. This is, you can't make this up, definitely not. Also, ziemlich unglaublich. Seine Firma hat eine ganze Weile auch die Verletzung von biologischen und chemischen Kriegsführungsregeln überprüft. Damals im Zusammenhang mit dem berüchtigten Anthrax-Gift. Das war ein paar Tage nach 9/11. Da wurden plötzlich im Kongress wurden Leute, zwei Senatoren, scheinbar vergiftet oder man versuchte sie mit dem Gift Anthrax zu vergiften. Da gab es ich glaube, es war sogar ein Impfstoff. Da gab es viele Patente drauf vom National Institute of Health oder eben dem eben genannten NIAID. Und es gab die Besorgnis bei der Firma von Dr. Martin, dass Corona als Träger für eine biologische Waffe benutzt werden könnte. Das war in 2001. Nach dem angeblichen Ausbruch von Corona, angeblich, sagt er, weil man weiß ja nicht genau, was wirklich passiert ist, in 2002 in China, von SARS, genau, im April 2003 hat das CDC, das Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, die gesamte Gensequenz, also CDC, das ist eine Behörde, das ist die wichtigste, unser RKI ist das, also eine Regierungsbehörde, aber wir wissen ja inzwischen, dass das Public-Private Partnerships sind, die im Wesentlichen private übernommen worden sind, hat das CDC die gesamte Gensequenz des Coronavirus patentieren lassen. Patentnummer 7220852. Das ist eine Verletzung der Regel, dass Natürliches, also hier natürliche Viren, gar nicht patentiert werden können. Aber sie haben es getan. Die haben aber nicht nur dieses Virus patentiert, sondern außerdem die Möglichkeiten, es zu finden per PCR-Test. Wie wir inzwischen wissen, geht das sowieso nicht, sondern das war alles nur Bestandteil dieser Pandemie. Aber auch die Möglichkeit, das Coronavirus überhaupt festzustellen, wurde patentiert, sodass beides im Eigentum der CDC stand und steht, nämlich einmal das Virus selbst und einmal die Möglichkeit, es zu finden. Angeblich, so hat das die Public Relations Abteilung mitgeteilt, sollte das zum Wohl der Öffentlichkeit passieren, damit jeder da mitspielen kann. Das aber, sagt Dr. Martin, ist eine einzige Lüge, denn es war ja gar nichts Neues da. Man hätte hier gar nichts patentieren können. 99% Übereinstimmung hat nämlich mit den schon bestehenden Viren, hat das Patent Office, das Patentamt festgestellt. Das hätte man gar nicht patentieren können. Aber die CDC hat gesagt, das ist mir doch egal, und hat diese Feststellung des Patentamtes einfach ignoriert, overruled, hat, und er sagt, das ist alles beweisbar, er hat die Unterlagen dabei, Schmiergeld an das Patent Office bezahlt, und damit das eben doch patentiert wird, und zusätzlich eine Gebühr dafür, dass das alles geheim bleibt. Es haben in der Zwischenzeit Fact-Checkers, we know what to think of Fact-Checkers, gesagt, nee, das ist schon okay, denn dieses SARS-CoV-2 ist völlig anders. Tatsache ist aber, dass eine so zwischen 89% und 99%ige Identität mit den vorangegangenen SARS-Viren besteht. Es wird noch ein bisschen spannender. 3 Tage nachdem diese Patentierung des Virus in 2003 durch die CDC erfolgte, hat eine Gruppe namens Sequoia Pharmaceuticals schon eine Behandlungsmethode für oder gegen das Virus patentieren lassen. 3 Tage danach. Nee, 3 Tage danach haben sie es patentieren lassen. Ja, 3 days later. Und das Interessante ist, das kann nur, sagt Dr. Martin, das kann nur Insider-Information gewesen sein, die dazu geführt hat. Denn die CDC haben ja extra das Patent Office geschmiert, damit niemand was von diesem Patent weiß. Und das war auch noch gar nicht bekannt, offiziell jedenfalls, sodass es hier nur um Insidergeschäfte gehen kann. 3 Tage danach, also die Behandlung selbst wurde patentiert, bevor offiziell die Krankheit bekannt war. Ich habe gesagt, das könnte explodieren als RICO-Case. Er sagt, das ist einer.
Yeah, well, it's going to get worse here.
Oh no, it can't get worse.
Oh, it does. In the 5th of June 2008, which is an important date because it is actually around the time when DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Program in the United States, actively took an interest in coronavirus as a biological weapon. June 5th, 2008, Ablinks, which as you know is now part of Sanofi, filed a series of patents that specifically targeted what we've been told is the novel feature of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And you heard what I just said. This is the 5th of June, 2008.
They filed what?
Specifically, they targeted what was called the polybasic cleavage site for SARS-CoV, the novel spike protein, and the ACE2 receptor binding domain, which is allegedly novel to SARS-CoV-2. And all of that was patented on the 5th of June, 2008. And those patents in sequence were issued between November 24th of 2015, which was U.S. patent 919-3780. So that one came out after The gain-of-function moratorium, that one came after the MERS outbreak in the Middle East. But what you find is that then in 2016, 2017, 2019, a series of patents all covering not only the RNA strands, but also the subcomponents of the gene strands were all issued to Ablinks and Sanofi. And then we have Crucell, we have Rubius Therapeutics, we have Children's Medical Corporation, we have countless others that include Ludwig Maximilian's Universität in München, mm-hmm. Protein Science Corporation, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, University of Iowa, University of Hong Kong, Chinese National Human Genome Center in Shanghai, all identifying in patent filings that ranged from 2008 until 2017, every attribute that was allegedly uniquely published by the single reference publication, the novel bat coronavirus, reveals, quote, natural insertions at the S1, S2, 2 cleavage site of the spike protein and possible recombinant 3 origin of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The paper that has been routinely used to identify the novel virus, unfortunately, if you actually take what they report to be novel, you find 73 patents issued between 2008 and 2019, which have the elements that were allegedly novel in the SARS-CoV-2, specifically as it relates to the polybasic cleavage site, the ACE2 receptor binding domain, and the spike protein. So the clinically novel components of the clinically unique, clinically contagious, you know where I'm going with this, okay? There was no outbreak of SARS because we had engineered all of the elements of that. And by 2016, the paper that was funded during the gain-of-function moratorium that said that the SARS coronavirus was poised for human emergence, written by none other than Ralph Baric, was not only poised for human emergence, but it was patented for commercial exploitation. 73 times.
Didn't Ralph Baric, I think I saw a video clip with him giving a speech in which he explicitly told the audience that you can make a lot of money with this.
Yes, you can. And he has made a lot of money doing this.
Oh.
So for those who want to live in the illusion that somehow or another that's the end of the story, be prepared for a greater disappointment, because somebody knew something in 2015 and 2016, which gave rise to my favorite quote of this entire pandemic. And by that, I'm not being cute. My favorite quote of this pandemic was a statement made in 2015 by Peter Daszak. The statement that was made by Peter Daszak in 2015, reported in the National Academies of Press publication, February 12, 2016, and I'm quoting, "We need to increase public understanding of the need for medical countermeasures such as a pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issues. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process," end quote.
That's quite shocking because I thought that...
Let me just read that again just because I don't know if I might get lost in translation. So let me just go ahead and read it slowly.
Yeah.
And as Americans love to do when speaking to a multilingual audience, maybe I should say it louder. I won't. We need to increase public understanding of the need for medical countermeasures such as a pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issues. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process. End quote.
That's really, I mean, Peter Doshi, wasn't he the one who...
No. Peter Daszak.
Oh, Daszak.
Peter Daszak, the head of EcoHealth Alliance.
Okay. Peter Doshi is a good guy.
Yeah, I was just...
Peter Daszak, the person who was independently corroborating the Chinese non-lab leak, non-theory, because there wasn't a lab leak. This was an intentional bioweaponization of spike proteins to inject into people to get them addicted to a pan coronavirus vaccine. This has nothing to do with a pathogen that was released, and every study that's ever been launched to try to verify a lab leak is a red herring.
And there's really nothing that is new in this.
Nothing. Zero. 73 patents on everything clinically novel. 73 all issued before 2019. And I'm going to give you the biggest bombshell of all to prove that this was actually not a release of anything, because patent 7279327, the patent on the recombinant nature of that lung-targeting coronavirus, was transferred mysteriously from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to the National Institutes of Health in 2018. Now, here's the problem with that. Under the Bayh-Dole Act, the U.S. government already has what's called a march-in right provision. That means if the U.S. government has paid for research, they are entitled to benefit from that research at their demand or at their whim. So explain why, in 2017 and 2018, suddenly the National Institutes of Health have to take ownership of the patent that they already had rights to, held by the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And how did they need to file a certificate of correction to make sure that it was legally enforceable? Because there was a typographical error in the grant reference in the first filing. So they needed to make sure that not only did they get it right, but they needed to make sure every typographical error that was contained in the patent was correct. On the single patent required to develop the Vaccine Research Institute's mandate, which was shared between the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in November of 2019 and Moderna in November of 2019, when UNC Chapel Hill, NIAID, and Moderna began the sequencing of a spike protein vaccine a month before an outbreak ever happened.
You have all the evidence, right?
Yep.
I'll have to translate this. Wo waren wir jetzt eben? Ah ja. Am 5. Juni 2008 haben Ablings und was heute Sanofi ist, oder beide zusammen, ein Patent beantragt auf so ziemlich alles, was mit diesen, also die RNA-Strands, die Subcomponents der Gene-Strands, also auf so ziemlich alles, was mit diesem SARS-Coronavirus zusammenhängt. Das Interessante daran ist, dass etwa um dieselbe Zeit oder kurz danach DARPA, das ist so ein Verteidigungsministeriums, also Militär, eine Militäreinheit, bevor die sich dafür für dieses Coronavirus aktiv interessierten als eine Biowaffe. Die danach wurden Patente auf so, wiederum so ziemlich alles eingetragen für Abilene Sanofi in nicht nur 2015, sondern 2016, 2019. Ich glaube, eben hat er gesagt, insgesamt 73 oder sowas, 73 Patente. Also da kann es nichts Neues mehr gegeben haben. Alles wurde patentiert. Das Paper, was das Neue, also man muss, um irgendetwas patentieren zu lassen, muss man was Neues haben. Nur natürliche Dinge kann man nicht patentieren. Das Paper, was das Neue identifiziert hatte, sagt selber, dass es 17 Patente zwischen 2008 und 2019 einschließlich für das Spike-Protein gegeben hat. Das war, bevor es überhaupt ein SARS-Outbreak gegeben hat. Nein, er sagt, nein, das stimmt nicht. Es gab gar keinen SARS-Outbreak, sondern wir haben das selber, wir haben das selber ausgelöst. Und ich glaube, das war auch wieder dieser Peter Daszak, als der sagte, oh mein Gott, jetzt ist das Coronavirus aber wirklich bereit und gefährlich, auch Menschen krank zu machen. Zu diesem Zeitpunkt war das alles patentiert. Also erinnern Sie sich daran, nicht nur das Virus selbst war patentiert, sondern auch schon die Behandlung, die Vakzine, die Behandlungsmöglichkeiten waren auch schon patentiert. Er hat eben ein besonderes Zitat von diesem Peter Daszak gemacht. Ich habe einen Clip von dem gesehen, wo er einer Gruppe von wahrscheinlich Wissenschaftlern und Investoren gesagt hat, dass man damit eine Menge Geld machen kann mit diesem Virus aus 2015. Und dieses Zitat lautet, wir müssen das öffentliche Verständnis befördern dafür, dass es eine Notwendigkeit für solche Impfungen gibt. Das wichtigste Mittel dafür, dieses öffentliche Verständnis zu fördern, sind die Medien. Die wirtschaftlichen Folgen werden automatisch dem Hype folgen, der durch die Medien kreiert wird. Und dieser Hype, auf diesen Hype werden dann potenzielle Investoren reagieren, wenn sie sehen, dass man am Ende damit sehr viel Geld verdienen kann. Das hat er zweimal vorgelesen.
You'll have to read it again.
No. You speak German, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Also dieses Spike-Protein wurde kreiert, um die Menschen abhängig machen zu können von einem weltweit verwendeten Corona-Impfstoff. Wie gesagt, 73 Patente gibt's auf alles, was angeblich im Jahre 2019 neu war. 73 Patente, bevor man dieses neue angebliche Coronavirus in 2019 ausrief. Es wurde dann das Patent das war glaube ich auch im November 2019, von der Chapel Hill University in North Carolina übertragen auf die NIH, obwohl komischerweise das ja eigentlich schon längst da sein müsste, da waren aber ein paar Fehler gemacht worden. Tatsache ist jedenfalls, dass dieses Virus, diese beiden Punkte muss man festhalten, dass dieses Virus lange, lange schon vorher patentiert war, die Behandlungsmethoden lange, lange vorher patentiert worden waren. Das alles sollte geheim gehalten werden. Deswegen gab es Schmiergeldzahlungen seitens der CDC an das Patent Office, damit das keiner rauskriegt. Und diese Impfungen wurden in Szene gesetzt. Dafür hat Dr. Martin den Evidence, also die ganzen schriftlichen Beweise. Dieses Virus wurde erfunden und patentiert und die Impfstoffe dazu, um damit richtig viel Kohle zu machen. Das ist eigentlich alles, worum es geht. So it's all about money.
It has always been about money. And just to answer a question that was asked slightly earlier, the script for this was written first January 6, 2004.
January 6, 2004. Who wrote the script?
Merck. At the conference called SARS and Bioterrorism.
Uh-huh.
Bioterrorism and emerging infectious diseases, antimicrobials, therapeutics, and immune modulators. Merck introduced the notion of what they called the new normal. Proper noun, the new normal. Which is the language that became the branded campaign that was adopted by the World Health Organization, the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, which was the board upon which the Chinese director of Center for Disease Control, Bill Gates's Dr. Elias of the Gates Foundation, and Anthony Fauci sat together on that board of directors. But the first introduction of the New Normal campaign, which was about getting people to accept a universal pan-influenza, pan-coronavirus vaccine, was actually adopted January 6, 2004. So it's been around quite a long time. I'm not going to belabor many more points other than to say that it was very clear that Merck knew that, sorry, that Moderna knew that it was going to be placed in the front of the line with respect to the development of a vaccine in March of 2019. And this is a very important date, because in March of 2019, for reasons that are not transparent, they suddenly amended a series of rejected patent filings, which is a very bizarre behavior. But they amended a number of patent filings to specifically make reference to an intentional or accidental release, deliberate release of coronavirus. So in March, they amended four failed patent applications to begin the process of a coronavirus vaccine development. And they began dealing with a very significant problem that they had, which was they relied on technology that they did not own. Two Canadian companies, Arbutus Pharmaceuticals and Acuitas Pharmaceuticals, actually own the patent on the lipid nanoparticle envelope that's required to deliver the injection of the mRNA fragment. And those patents have been issued both in Canada and in the US and then around the world in their world intellectual property equivalents. Moderna knew that they did not own the rights and began trying to negotiate with Arbutus and Acuitas to get the resolution of the lipid nanoparticle patented technology available to be put into a vaccine. And we know, as I made reference to before, that in November, they entered into a research and cooperative research and development agreement with UNC Chapel Hill with respect to getting the spike protein to put inside of the lipid nanoparticle so that they actually had a candidate vaccine before we had a pathogen allegedly that was running around. What makes that story most problematic, beyond the self-evident nature of it, is that we know that from 2016 until 2019, at every one of the NIAID Advisory Council board meetings, Anthony Fauci lamented the fact that he could not find a way to get people to accept the universal influenza vaccine, which is what was his favorite target. He was trying to get the population to engage in this process. And what becomes very evident with Peter Daszak, EcoHealth Alliance, UNC Chapel Hill, and others, and then most specifically by March of 2019, in the amended patent filings of Moderna, we see that there is an epiphany that says, What if there was an accidental or an intentional release of a respiratory pathogen? And what makes that particular phrase problematic is it is exactly recited in the book A World at Risk, which is the scenario that was put together by the World Health Organization in September of 2019. So months before there's an alleged pathogen, which says that we need to have a coordinated global experience of a respiratory pathogen release, which by September 2020 must put in place a universal capacity for public relations management, crowd control, and the acceptance of a universal vaccine mandate. That was September of 2019. And the language of an intentional release of a respiratory pathogen was written into the scenario that, quote, must be completed by September 2020.
This was a text where Mrs. Brundtland was heading this commission, isn't it?
Well, this is the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board's unified statement. There are a number of people who have taken credit and then backed away from credit for it. But yes, you're right.
Am I right, too, when I say that also the ACE2 receptor that was already described in the patents before 2019?
Yes, we have 117 patents with specifically the ACE2 receptor targeting mechanism for SARS coronavirus.
So because they always say this is the new thing with the virus.
No, it's not new, and it has not been even remotely new. It's in publications going back to 2008 in the weaponization conferences that took place in Slovenia, in Europe, all across Europe, and all across the DARPA infrastructure. We've known about that since 2013, its isolation and amplification.
And this, the amendment that Merck did to this, the reject and patent applications, so was it only about the fact that it's like deliberately, you know, like put into the environment or something, or did they add anything else?
Well, so these were there were four failed patent applications that were essentially revitalized in March of 2019. And it was Moderna. I misspoke. I spoke about Merck. It was Moderna, and I tried to correct that. I'm sorry that that didn't come through. But it's Moderna's patent applications that were amended in March of 2019 to include the deliberate release of a respiratory pathogen language.
Those had not been rejected for some reason. They were just they were just sitting there, basically.
No, they do processes similar to other pharmaceutical companies where they evergreen applications and continually modify applications to enjoy the earliest priority dates available. Okay. But that's why you have to go back and look at the amendment of the application records to find out when the actual amendment language was put in place. But yes, I mean, the fact of the matter is, and like I said, I'm not going to belabor all of the patent data, but any assertion that this pathogen is somehow unique or novel falls apart on the actual gene sequences which are published in the patent record, and then more egregiously falls apart in the fact that we have Peter Daszak himself stating that we have to create public hype to get the public to accept the medical countermeasure of a pan-coronavirus vaccine. And what makes that most ludicrous is the fact that, as we know, World Health Organization had declared coronavirus a dead interest. I mean, they said that we had eradicated coronavirus as a concern. So why, having eradicated it in 2007 and 2008, why did we start spending billions of dollars globally on a vaccine for a thing that had been eradicated by declaration in 2008, kind of falls into the zone of incredulity, to say the least.
Doesn't that also mean if you take the entirety of the evidence, then this is a tool, the coronavirus and the vaccines, this is a tool And the interest of DARPA in creating a biological weapon out of this, this is a tool for everything else that latches onto this, including population control, for example.
Well, listen, we have to stop falling for even the mainstream narrative in our own line of questioning. Because the fact of the matter is, this was seen as a highly malleable bioweapon. There is no question that by 2005, it was unquestionably a weapon of choice. And the illusion that we continue to unfortunately see very well-meaning people get trapped in is conversations about whether we're having a vaccine for a virus. The fact of the matter is we're not. We are injecting a spike protein mRNA sequence, which is a computer simulation. It's not derived from nature. It's a computer simulation of a sequence which has been known and patented for years. And what we know is that that sequence, as reported, is reported across things like, you know, the very reliable phone conversations that took place between Moderna and the Vaccine Research Center by self-report, where, I don't know, if you were on a phone call and you heard ATTCCGGTTCCGABBB, you know, is there any chance you might get a letter, a vowel or a consonant dropped here or there? The ludicrous nature of the story that this is somehow prophylactic or preventative flies in the face of 100% of the evidence, because the evidence makes it abundantly clear that there has been no effort by any pharmaceutical company to combat the virus. This is about getting people injected with the known to be harmful S1 spike protein. So the cover story is that if you get an expression of a spike protein, you're going to have some sort of general symptomatic relief. But the fact of the matter is, there has never been an intent to vaccinate a population as defined by the vaccination universe. And it's important. I mean, let's review just for the record. When Anthony Fauci tried desperately to get some of his, quote, synthetic RNA vaccines published, he had his own patents rejected by the patent office. And I want to read what the patent office told him when NIAID's own Anthony Fauci thought that he could get an mRNA-like vaccine patented as a vaccine. And here's the quote. These arguments are persuasive to the extent that an antigenic peptide stimulates an immune response that may produce antibodies that bind to a specific peptide or protein, but it is not persuasive in regards to a vaccine. Okay? This is the patent office. This is not some sort of public health agency. This is the patent office. The immune response produced by a vaccine must be more than merely some immune response, but must also be protective. As noted in the previous office action, the art recognizes the term vaccine to be a compound which prevents infection. Applicant has not demonstrated that the instantly claimed vaccine meets even the lower standard set forth in the specification, let alone the standard art definition for being operative in regards. Therefore, claims 5, 7, and 9 are not operative, as the anti-HIV vaccine, which is what he was working on, is not patentable utility. So Anthony Fauci himself was told by the patent office themselves that what he was proposing as a vaccine does not meet the patentable standard, the legal standard, or the clinical standard.
Oh. Can we translate this for our audience? This might be very important.
That is, by the way, David, that is our friend Martin Schwab, Professor Martin Schwab of the He's our most important legal advisor from the University of Bielefeld. He is very smart. Also, dann wollen wir das mal übersetzen. Wir haben eben noch mal von Dr. Martin gehört, dass die Truppe, die sich also die Eingriffsrechte, die Impfrechte gesichert hatte, Moderna ganz vorneweg, die standen im März 2019 in der ersten Reihe für diese Impfstoffe. März 2019, wohlgemerkt, da gab es keine Pandemie, da gab es noch nicht mal den Krankheitserreger. Die hatten nur das eine Problem. Naja, die haben sogar sich patentieren lassen, dass sie mit ihrem Impfstoff sogar dann zum Zuge kommen, wenn das Virus absichtlich freigesetzt wird. Das muss man sich mal vorstellen. Absichtlich freigesetzt wird. Also zu einem Zeitpunkt, als es das Virus offiziell noch gar nicht gab. Nun konnten sie es aber gar nicht.
Du musst sagen, dass sie das in dem März 2019 hinzugefügt haben, den Aspekt.
Ja.
Also in der, da haben sie dass die den Antrag, den Patentantrag erweitert.
Genau.
Um diesen Aspekt, dass es auch für absichtlich in die.
Genau, das war bei der Gelegenheit, da gab es ein paar Schreibfehler und dann haben sie die Gelegenheit wahrgenommen und haben das auch noch reingebaut. Nicht nur die Schreibfehler korrigiert im ursprünglichen Patent, sondern auch den Rest oder Patent. Antrag. Nun konnten sie es aber nicht benutzen, weil man braucht diesen Lipid-Umschlag sozusagen, die Lipid-Umhüllung, um die mRNA in den Körper einzubringen. Das hatten sie aber nicht, sondern die Rechte daran, das Patent daran, gehörte einer kanadischen Gesellschaft. Dann wollten sie im November 2019, also Moderna, die in der ersten Reihe für die Impfung standen, wohlgemerkt November 2019 immer noch keine Pandemie zu sehen, da wollten sie mit Chapel Hill, mit der Universität in North Carolina, einen Deal machen, wie man denn wohl diese mRNA in den Körper reinbringen können. Vorher, darauf hat Dr. Martin eben auch nochmal hingewiesen, hatte Fauci erfolglos versucht und hat sich enttäuscht darüber ausgedrückt, dass es einfach nicht geklappt hat, die Bevölkerung an massenhafte Grippeimpfungen zu gewöhnen. Da wollten sie einfach nicht mitmachen. Also braucht man ja wohl eine Pandemie und was Härteres, damit sie dann doch bei Impfungen mitmachen. Und es gibt sogar 117 Patente auf diesen ACE2-Rezeptor. In 2005 wurde das Ganze schon als Möglichkeit zur Kreation einer Biowaffe angesehen. Und die Schlussfolgerung, die Dr. Martin daraus zieht, ist, wer hier immer noch in der Öffentlichkeit glaubt, dass es um Impfungen für die Gesundheit der Menschen geht, der liegt sowas von neben der Spur. Wir injizieren eine Computersimulation mit einem basierend auf einer Computersimulation die Menschen mit einem bekannten gefährlichen Spike Protein. Eine Anekdote noch: Fauci vom NIAID wollte ein Patent für mRNA-Vakzine ein bisschen früher schon haben. Das Patent Office hat ihm damals aber gesagt, das geht gar nicht. Für diese von dir gewünschten Impfungen kannst du kein Patent kriegen, weil der Körper muss mehr machen als nur eine Immunreaktion absetzen. Der Körper muss oder das Immunsystem muss mit einer schützenden Reaktion, die auch eine Weiterverbreitung verhindert, reagieren. Hier sind weder der patentrechtliche noch der rechtliche noch die klinischen Voraussetzungen für eine Patentierung gegeben. Trotzdem gibt es das alles jetzt. Und das Ganze ist, wie man ganz klar und deutlich nach all dem, was Dr. Martin uns erzählt hat, annehmen muss, von Anfang an ausschließlich zu dem Zweck gemacht worden, erstens Geld zu verdienen mit einer Krankheit, die man erst noch patentieren musste und einem Impfstoff, den man erst noch patentieren musste. Und das Ganze ist am Ende eben, das sind wohl die beiden wichtigsten Punkte hier, eben gerade keine Impfung, die der Gesundheit dient, sondern hier werden Menschen bewusst mit einem gefährlichen Erreger, oder es wird Menschen bewusst ein gefährlicher Erreger, nämlich dieses Spike-Protein, injiziert. I know that, David, I know a lot of our viewers are really shocked. I can see that from the responses. One of our viewers is our PCR test specialist, Professor Kemmerer. She can't believe what's going on here.
Well, here's the sad and sober irony is that I raised these issues beginning in 2002 after the anthrax scare. And the tragedy is we are now sitting in a world where we have hundreds of millions of people who are being injected with a pathogen stimulating computer sequence, which is being sold under what the patent office, what the medical profession, and what the FDA in its own clinical standards would not suggest is a vaccine. But by using the term, we actually are now subjecting hundreds of millions of people to what was known to be by 2005 a biological weapon.
Also, das, was ihn so ein bisschen bedrückt und vielleicht sogar sehr bedrückt, ist, dass er schon seit 2002 auf diese Gefahr, die jetzt sich gerade realisiert hat, hingewiesen hat. Seit 2005 wird das Ganze diskutiert als biologische Waffe und jetzt haben wir hunderte von Millionen Menschen letzten Endes, das ist jetzt meine Kurzfassung, vergiftet mit etwas, was zwar als Impfstoff bezeichnet wird, was aber selbst das Patent Office, als Fauci versucht hat, ein Patent zu kriegen, gesagt hat, das kann man gar nicht patentieren, weil es nämlich kein Impfstoff ist, weil es nicht dazu führt, dass jemand immun wird. Die Immunreaktion, es gibt zwar eine Immunreaktion, aber nicht die, die man braucht, damit das Ganze patentiert werden kann, damit man also geschützt ist.
So I obviously have hundreds of hours of this stuff committed to memory because I've been doing it for two decades. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I'm sure there are going to be hundreds of questions, David. We're going to be in touch. I think you're going to be flooded by people, by people's emails, etc. I'm just going to forward what comes in, or we're going to forward what comes in. But I do think, we have Martin Schwab. He probably has a really serious question.
And after me, Wolfgang too. Okay, I'm a legal professor with the Faculty of Law here in Bielefeld, and I have to tell you that the Constitutional Protection Unit of the Ministry of Interior Affairs observes the so-called corona denial scene. Corona denier is everyone who dares to disagree to the
with the official line.
With the official line, yes. No? If this Constitutional Protection Unit takes notice of me taking part in discussion that this pandemic was put on stage intentionally, they will probably try to fire me from my job. So I have to at least ask some questions. While I heard you talking, I took a look at patent number. Which one was it? 7220852 and 7151163. And 7220852 was filed in April 12, and 715 and so on was filed in April 28 of 2004. I see a difference between 16, not 3 days. What did I misunderstand?
Now, April 23rd, 2003 was the CDC master filing date.
Okay. I asked this question because if they try to make me redundant for my job, I have to provide strong evidence.
No, we have – listen, we have all of this sent to I know Dr. Fulmich has the entire record in The Fauci dossier, 100% of this record is in there. The additional addendum that I sent across all has the records in there, including all the priority filing dates as well as the issue dates. So 100% of this is in written published records, and you have the written records.
Okay.
I have created my own file, and it's labeled David Martin.
Okay. Okay. There is I did analysis of media reportings here, and I can confirm that they give a very one-sided account on the pandemic. Everyone who dares to declare the threat less dangerous than the government does will be denounced as conspiracy theorists, as tinfoil, and so on. You know? So the media exactly did what you pointed out in the sentence you you repeated twice before. You know? Actually, they tell us the story of the Delta variant, which is told to be much more contagious than everything else. Experts I have spoken to told me that the databases contain as many as more of 40,000 virus strains.
Correct.
So could this Delta variant be some kind of media hype you told us about before?
There is no such thing as an alpha or a beta or gamma or delta variant. This is a means by which what is desperately sought is a degree to which individuals can be coerced into accepting something that they would not otherwise accept. There has not been in any of the published studies on what has been reportedly the Delta variant, there has not been a population R naught calculated, which is the actual replication rate. What has been estimated are computer simulations. But unfortunately, if you look at GISAID, which is the public source of uploading any one of a number of variations, what you'll find is that there has been no ability to identify any clinically altered gene sequence, which has then a clinically expressed variation. And this is the problem all along. This is the problem going back to the very beginning of what's alleged to be a pandemic, is we do not have any evidence that the gene sequence alteration had any clinical significance whatsoever. There has not been a single paper published by anyone that has actually established that anything novel since November of 2019 has clinical distinction from anything that predates November of 2019. The problem with the 73 patents that I described is that those 73 patents all contain what was reported to be novel in December and January of 2019 and 2020, respectively. So the problem is that even if we were to accept that there are idiopathic pneumonias, even if we were to accept that there are some set of pathogen-induced symptoms, we do not have a single piece of published evidence that tells us that anything about the subclade SARS-CoV-2 has clinical distinction from anything that was known and published prior to November 2019 in 73 patents dating to 2008.
But could it be that the Delta variant sort of is that just the difference is, you know, that the clinical symptoms are the same, but that it has the capability of like infecting someone who's already gone through like variant B, Beta, whatever.
Well, so this is where we see an enormous amount of response and reflexive behavior to media hype. There is no, and I'm going to repeat this, there is no evidence that the Delta variant is somehow distinct from anything else on GIS AID. The fact that we are now looking for a thing doesn't mean that it is a thing, because we are looking at fragments of things. And the fact is that if we choose any fragment, I could come up with, you know, I could come up with variant Omega tomorrow.
Yes.
And I could come up with variant Omega, and I could say, I'm looking for this sub strand of either DNA or RNA, or even a protein. And I could run around the world going, oh my gosh, fear the Omega variant.
Yes.
And the problem is that because of the nature of the way in which we currently sequence genomes, which is actually a compositing process, it's what we call in mathematics an interleaving, we don't have any point of reference to actually know whether or not the thing we're looking at is in fact distinct from either clinical or even genomic sense. And so we're trapped in a world where, unfortunately, if you go and look, as I have, at the papers that isolated the Delta variant and actually ask the question, is the Delta variant anything other than the selection of a sequence in a systematic shift of an already disclosed other sequence? The answer is it's just an alteration in when you start and stop what you call the reading frame. There is no novel anything. Yes, Wolfgang.
Ja, darf ich? Ich möchte gerne Deutsch sprechen, weil ja. Ich jetzt gelernt habe, dass Dr. Martin das verstehen könnte. Dann ersparen wir uns Übersetzungen.
I can understand most of it.
Okay, I hope so. So, ich habe das mal von der Variante Husum erzählt. Erinnert ihr euch? Das ist ein Dorf in Schleswig-Holstein. Auch da gibt es Coronaviren. Und wenn man von Husum und nicht von Wuhan taxonomisch den Baum jetzt verfolgt hätte, dann hätte man einen ähnlichen Baum. Das hätte man auch machen können von Düsseldorf oder von San Francisco oder von Rio. Überall hätte man einen Baum gefunden. Und überall hätte man gesehen, dass es immer neue Varianten gibt und dass die sich austauschen. Das ist eine Menge von Informationen, die ausgetauscht wird, und das seit Tausenden von Jahren. Und was da jetzt angeschaut wird, das ist tatsächlich, ich sehe das auch so, das ist einfach, dass man sich etwas, das Einzige, was man aus diesen Datenbanken sieht, das ist die Tatsache, wo die Leute angefangen haben zu denken, die sie gemacht haben. Mehr sieht man da nicht aus. Und ich denke, es ist unheimlich wichtig auch, dass wir das zur Kenntnis nehmen, dass die Natur hier laufend neue Varianten herstellt und dass unser Immunsystem sich daran eben ja adaptiert hat. Wir wissen, dass die Herdenimmunität über 90% besteht, weil es eben so ist, weil wir diese Viren kennen und weil unser Immunsystem sie kennt. Und das bisschen, was sich immer mal ändert, wie das Wetter sich ändert, darauf können wir uns einstellen, damit können wir auskommen. Ich finde es unheimlich schön, wie Sie das Patentsystem angeschaut haben. Und ich glaube, ich habe diese Anregung ja schon mehrfach gemacht, wir brauchen unbedingt Patentanwälte, denn dann wissen wir, welche Pläne gesponnen werden, was man da so vorhat. Denn natürlich werden die Claims abgesteckt, bevor dann einer kommt und sie verteidigt. Und ich finde es so verdienstvoll, was Sie gemacht haben. Und ich kann Ihren Schmerz sehr verstehen, den Sie haben, dass Sie so viele Jahre lang nicht gehört wurden. Ich habe mal mit einem Vertreter mit dem Justiziar von Göringer Ingelheim gesprochen, Herrn Laurin heißt er. Der hat zusammen mit einigen Ministerialbeamten, hat der sich das Europäische Patentamt ausgedacht. Und es gab dann eine Gang, das war die Alicante Gang. Und diese Alicante Gang hat dann eine Konkurrenz für das amerikanische Patentsystem praktisch entwickelt und erfunden. Die haben sich regelmäßig getroffen und haben dann nachher das Europäische Patent Office in München geschaffen. Und das war eine neue Kreation, einfach im Wettbewerb US-Patent, europäisches Patent. Und ich finde, diese Art, wie diese Patentämter arbeiten, sind auch interessant. Das finanziert sich durch die Gebühren. Und das finanziert sich nochmal wieder bei Widersprüchen. Also die, egal, die geben auch gerne Patente auf etwas, was man eigentlich nicht patentieren kann und verdienen dann nochmal wieder, wenn sie den Widerspruch denn bearbeiten. Die haben ihr eigenes Rechtssystem, auch nachdem sie das alles beurteilen. Das ist keine Institution, die irgendwie parlamentarisch kontrolliert wird, sondern das ist eine Institution, die von der Industrie und von einigen wirtschaftsinteressierten Regierungen geschaffen worden ist, als Wirtschaftsinstrument. Da geht es darum, dass man geistiges Eigentum privatisiert. Und das sind Dinge, die schwer sind, zu verstehen sind. Aber das Europäische Patentamt, da gehört die Türkei dazu, da gehört die Schweiz dazu. Das hat mit der EU überhaupt nichts zu tun. Es gibt keinerlei parlamentarische Kontrolle. Dieses Patent Office kontrolliert sich selbst. Und so ist es, wie ich weiß, auch mit anderen Patent Offices überall in der Welt. Das sind wirtschaftliche Einrichtungen, mit denen die Ideen, die es gibt, dann privatisiert werden. Und das ist ein Thema, denke ich, was für die Politik wichtig ist zu verstehen, weil wenn es keine Patente gäbe auf Medikamente und auf Impfstoffe, dann würden wir das alles nicht erleben, was wir erleben. Ja. Ich habe Gelbfieberimpfstoff verimpft. Der kam aus dem Paul-Ehrlich-Institut, der wurde dort noch hergestellt. Und da hat keiner dran verdient, sondern es war ein Kostenfaktor, das hat was gekostet, aber das war keine Möglichkeit, Geld zu verdienen. Als es privatisiert wurde, da ist Gelbfieber plötzlich ganz anders. Da ist es also etwas, woran man Geld verdienen kann. Und so gilt es für all diese Impfstoffe. Und ich denke, wir müssen da grundsätzlich systemisch auch mal dran gehen, dass wir die Frage, wie jetzt der Erfinder belohnt werden soll, dass wir die mal diskutieren. Es hat bei der WHO 2004 oder 2005 eine Frau Dreyfus gegeben. Das ist die Sozialministerin der Schweiz. Die hat eine Arbeitsgruppe geleitet und diese Arbeitsgruppe hat ausgerechnet, wie viel es kostet, wenn wir die Erfinder mit Patenten belohnen und wie viel es kosten würde, wenn wir die Forschung staatlich fördern würden, die wir brauchen. Und diese beiden Dinge gegeneinander gestellt, wenn ich mich richtig erinnere, war das System, die Erfinder mit Patenten zu belohnen, fünfmal so teuer, als wenn man die Forschung direkt finanzieren würde nach dem Bedarf, der da ist, nach dem gesundheitlichen Bedarf. Also das ist eine Geschichte, die jetzt, wenn wir über Patente reden, und das haben wir ja eben getan, die, denke ich, wichtig ist als Hintergrund. Aber Ihr großes Verdienst, Dr. Martin, liegt wirklich darin, dass Sie einerseits Patente lesen können, dass Sie wissen, wo Sie sie finden können und dass Sie diese Zeitreihe so sehr schön dokumentiert haben, die wirklich unwiderlegbar zeigt, dass das Ganze geplant ist, dass das Ganze wirtschaftlichen Hintergründe hat, Machthintergründe hat, dass das Zusammenspiel zwischen staatlichen Institutionen einerseits und Wirtschaft andererseits und Militär dann außerdem noch wieder als dritten Faktor, dass das hier diese ganze Sache schon lange, lange geplant hat, vorbereitet hat, die Claims abgesteckt hat und ganz genau wusste, was es mit uns machen will. Und dass es uns mit Hilfe der Medien jetzt belügt und dass wir mit Hilfe der Medien jetzt dazu gebracht werden, diese Story zu glauben. Und das, was wir geimpft kriegen, das haben Sie auch sehr schön gesagt, das ist nicht eine Impfung gegen einen Virus, den es gibt, sondern das ist eine Impfung gegen eine Computersimulation, die als Biowaffe mal erfunden worden ist. Daraus hat man etwas genommen. Das wurde schon lange patentiert und das kriegen wir jetzt gespritzt. Und zwar sind das mRNA-Stücke, die dazu führen, dass wir giftige Spikes in unserem Körper bilden. Und die Nebenwirkungen, die wir da haben, das sehen wir ja überall. Wir sehen die Zahlen der Nebenwirkungen, die ganz stark steigen. Was hier geschieht, ist ein großes Verbrechen. Vielen Dank, dass Sie uns das wirklich so, dass Sie uns den Beweis damit auch in die Hand gegeben haben. Ich hoffe, dass viele Menschen das sehen und ich denke, es wird sich lohnen, das auch auf Deutsch einmal zusammenzuschreiben, diese Geschichte, die Sie uns erzählt haben, mit allen Quellen. Und ja, das ist eine schöne Aufgabe, die wir haben. Okay. Herzlichen Dank.
David, I'll make a long story very short. He's in full agreement with your analysis. He understands your anguish with respect to you having told the world about this 20 years ago almost, and he admires your tenacity, and he's extremely grateful for you having taken this very close look at the problem through patent law. Dr. Wodak believes that patents are really problematic because it turns out that it is probably 5 times more expensive to patent drugs as opposed to having public, I mean, not public, private, but public universities getting the stipends, getting the money that they need in order to develop these vaccines.
Yeah, let me, I'm going to do something that's very unfair, but I'm going to hold a document very close to the screen. Mm-hmm. And it's only for representational purposes, but I want you to see that this is the Barrick patent that NIH needed to have returned to them for mysterious reasons in 2018. This is 7279327, and people can look this up on their own. But if you actually look at the sequences that are patented, which is one of the things that we've done, we actually look at the published sequences and realize that depending on where you clip the actual sequence string, you will have the same thing or you'll have a different thing based nothing more than on where you decide to parse the clip. And I want to read you, I mean, this is something that comes directly from their patent application. When they actually talk about the DNA strands, which they call sequence ID numbers, they actually specifically say the organism is an artificial sequence. An artificial sequence, meaning that it is not a sequence that has a rule base in nature. It is not something that was manifest for a particular natural derivative protein or natural derivative mRNA sequence that was isolated. Every one of these is, in fact, a synthetic artificial sequence. And if you go back and you look at each one of them, which we have done, what you'll find is that the sequences, in fact, are contiguous in many instances, but are overlapping in others, where it is merely a caprice determination that says something is or is not part of an open reading frame, or is or is not part of a particular oligonucleotide sequence. Now, the reason why that's important is because if we are going to examine what ultimately is being injected into individuals, we need the exact sequence, not a kind of similar to. We need the exact sequence. And if you look at the FDA's requirement, and if you look at the European regulatory environment, and if you look at the rest of the world's regulatory environment, for reasons that cannot be explained, the exact sequence that has gone into what is amplified inside of the injection seems to be elusive. It seems to be something that someone cannot, in fact, state with 100% certainty. The sequence is X. The problem that presents is that at this point in time, as much as we can be told that there are, you know, clinical trials going on and there are all sorts of other things going on, we have no way of verifying that a complete sequence has been, is, or potentially even could be manufactured into what ultimately becomes the lipid nanoparticle that is the carrier frequency into which the injection is delivered. And it's important for people to understand that as far back as 2002 and all the way through the patent filings of 2003 and then the weaponization patents that began in 2008, in every one of these instances, fragments are identified, but they are identified without specificity. So we don't have direct terminal ends of the fragments. We have fragments which have, you know, essentially hypothecated gaps into which anything can be placed. And that's the reason why I find the fact checking around the patent situation to be most disappointing. Because the reason why fact checkers, among their general lazy attributes, the reason why fact checkers are not actually checking facts when it comes to the patent matters is because the actual sequences are not represented in a digital form that makes it easy to do this comparison. We literally had to take images of submitted typed paper and then code those in to do our own assessment. You cannot do this on the EPO's patent site. You cannot do this with WIPO data from Geneva. You cannot do this with the U.S. Patent Office data. You actually have to go in and reconstruct the actual gene sequences by hand, and then you compare them to what has been uploaded on the public servers. And that's where you find that the question of novelty is something that was not addressed. This was a manufactured illusion.
I have one more question. Is it possible that we see that the influenza has vanished, is gone? We don't have influenza anymore. The influenza for sure is, the viruses are also sequenced. And is it possible that those parts, sequences we now speak about, that they may exist in both of the virus types, so that it's just a matter of testing and a matter of instruments to observe what we find, whether we find influenza or whether we find corona? If you have a word with five letters, and you will find this five letters in many books.
Right, exactly.
Wolfgang,
your question is a beautiful metaphor of exactly the problem. The problem is, if what we're looking for is something we've decided is worth looking for, then we'll find it. And the good news is we'll find it a bunch of places. And if we've decided that we're no longer looking for a thing, it's not entirely surprising that we don't find it, because we're not looking for it. The fact of the matter is, whether it's the RT-PCR tests that we decided that there are fragments, which, by the way, I have looked at every one of the regulatory submissions that has been submitted to the FDA to try to figure out what was the gold standard to get the emergency use authorization, and what fragment of SARS-CoV-2 was officially the official fragment that was the comparator standard. And the problem is that you can't get a single standard. So the question becomes, in a world where there is no single standard, what is it that you actually find? Because if I'm looking for, and why don't I just read this? If I'm looking for CCACGCTTTG, do I add the next strand G, or do I go, no, the next bit is GTTTAGTTCG? And you get the point. The point is that where I choose to start and stop, I can actually say, I found it. Oh, I didn't find it.
Yeah.
And I didn't find the match that I projected onto the data because I chose to look at the data in a way that I could not find the match. Influenza did not leave the human population. Influenza was a failed decade-long pan-influenza vaccine mandate that was desperately, desperately, desperately promoted by governments around the world. They failed, and they decided if influenza doesn't deliver on the public promise of getting everybody to get an injection, let's change the pathogen.
There are many more they can change.
Oh, goodness, we've got tons more to come.
Yes, but now we're on to them.
I would like to tell you something about this development of the Drosten PCR test, you know, because we looked at it, I mean, just briefly, not to that extent that you now looked at the patents that you just described, but we looked at this kind of miracle or, like, I mean, strange aspect of, like, the Drosten test development, because he, despite the fact that he would have needed to basically, through his employer, the Charité, who would be entitled to holding the patents on his invention, he just published the instruction to the WHO, so everyone could see it. So basically, the whole invention lost its the possibility to be patented, and that's kind of strange, you know, when you look at it. So we asked the Charité in a Freedom of Information Act request, And so they said, well, you know, because there was so much rush to get the you know, this the test out, because there was this
pandemic going on.
So it was like, we didn't look at the finances, you know, we just didn't care. So that's kind of strange as a procedure, because I mean, basically this test is worth like billions, you know. How could you just, I mean, this is a publicly financed hospital, how can they just give give away all this whole thing? And then, because he was also in close cooperation with a private company, Tip Mol Biol, it's the same with which he had developed all the PCR tests from 2002, from the first SARS and then MERS, Zika, and so on and so on. So it's very strange, you know, because he was basically like functioning as a door opener for this company, you know, because they also said to us, so basically it was Drosten who decided to which possible country or like laboratory or whatever the test, this, you know, Tip Mol Biol company would send out the test kits in order to then, of course, make more money, because he was basically like, he had a first mover advantage, you know, Drosten and or this company. So it's clear now, I mean, maybe there was nothing at that point, because there were so many patents already going on. So basically, from this not novel virus or PCR test, he couldn't patent anything that would have been new. So basically, it was really like a very logical thing to do then, to use the whole thing as a, just to, you know, make profit from this first mover advantage. And maybe Drosten is somehow involved in this whole legal scheme.
He's one of the most important people in this scheme, because he's the one whose strings they pulled first.
Yeah, you need to create the illusion of demand, and there is nothing right now that does a better job of creating the illusion of demand than the urgency of an event that you've manufactured.
This sounds almost like comedy, but it is not.
Well, it is, in that we have to realize that part of the reason why it was so easy for us to monitor and track this particular, you know, campaign of coercion and terror was because we've done it before. You know, I started my comments by making sure people remember that when it came to solving for the anthrax outbreak, you know, remember that while we had hundreds of thousands of military people in the Middle East allegedly getting even for the events of September of 2001, we had two postal inspectors investigating anthrax. Two. The largest alleged bioweapons attack on U.S. soil, and we had two postal inspectors. You can't genuinely believe that two postal inspectors are the, you know, the crime-stopping, you know, mind, you know, bendingly powerful individuals in the universe. Now, I have nothing against postal inspectors, but I can guarantee you that if I was investigating a bioterror attack, I would not have the post office having two postal inspectors as their crack team doing the investigation. You know, it was disingenuous, and Congress knew it. And that's the reason why, you know, we publish a thing that is not necessarily a bestseller, but we publish an intelligence briefing on every violation of the biological and chemical weapons treaties that people have signed around the world. And it's a phone book that tells you where and who and who's funding. And so for us, it wasn't hard to figure out that this was not a public health crisis. This was an opportunistic marketing campaign to address a stated objective. And that's why this is Occam's razor. It's the easiest thing to describe, because they're the ones that said it. And the Occam's razor reality is they said they needed to get the public to accept a pan-coronavirus vaccine countermeasure. And they needed the media to create the hype, and investors would follow where they see profit. You do not have anything else you need to rely on to explain the events of the last 20 months than the actual statement of the actual perpetrator. And I don't do the navel-gazing exercise of going in to try to understand whether there were mommy issues behind a bank robber. If they're holding a bag of money outside of a bank, I actually make the crazy assumption that maybe they're a bank robber. Similarly, if I have somebody who says we need to use the media to hype a medical countermeasure, which is in fact the injection of a synthetic recombinant chimeric protein developed off of a computer simulation, if I'm actually going to listen to the motivation for why that might be being done, I will listen to the person doing the manipulation who says investors will follow where they see profit. I don't need more explanation.
Me neither. Okay. This is mind-boggling. I'm really glad, David, that we spoke a couple of months ago, maybe three, four months ago, and we were introduced to each other by James Henry.
Right.
And I was trying to find patent lawyers in this country who might be interested in this case. Now, there are a few patent lawyers who understand about it, but there's no one, apparently up till now, but maybe this is going to change, but there was no one willing to tackle this in the context of Corona. That's the problem.
But this is not new. I tried to find such a lawyer too, specialized on patents, for the Enquete Commission for the German Bundestag some 10 years ago, or more than 15 years ago, and we did not find, because they were all afraid to be critical on the system, because they would destroy their own job. This was very difficult.
Yeah, bear in mind that this is an old problem, because here's where the problem comes in. Ever since the establishment of the European Patent Office, the Germans and the French, not surprisingly, have maintained animosity that has, you know, been just this newest version of animosity that goes back centuries. But when the EPO was set up, the role of the Patent Office in Munich became a very nationalistic issue for Germany. And the notion that German patent examiners and German patent professionals still enjoyed supremacy over the rest of Europe became dogmatic. In 2003 and 2004, when the European Patent Office was first audited by my organization, and where we showed that somewhere between 20 and 30% of the patents in Europe were functional forgeries, meaning that they were copied from previous patents, The German representation of the European Patent Office lost their mind at the notion that they were doing anything remotely wrong. When the European Union commissioned us to do an examination into software patents a few years later at the request of the Swedish delegation to the European Union, and we showed hundreds and hundreds of software patents which were illegally granted by the European Union through the EPO, and then we found out that it was German patent examiners and German patent practitioners who were the ones who were responsible for their filing, we once again saw that there was an enormous outcry. And so what happens is that we have a dogmatically held position, which says that even though the European Patent Office is supposed to be pan-European, there is still in the minds of the German patent establishment a supremacy over the rest of Europe. And if you call into question anything, including patents granted on a bioweapon, you are treading on ground that there is no forgiveness for.
Yes, we had some questions from Transparency International, and we were wiped out. The topic was not followed.
Yep. You just can't. It's not. it's not accessible, and that's just the tragedy of what has unfortunately become a regulatory capture organization. It's actually not doing the public service.
Also, das können wir kurz ansprechen und zusammenfassen. David bestätigt im Grunde das, was Wolfgang vorhin schon gesagt hat. Diese Patentierung, insbesondere hier im Europäischen Patent Office, was so ein bisschen die Allmacht, die bis dahin bestehende Allmacht des deutschen Patentamts in München, ja.
Europäische Patente.
Nee, es gab das. Es gab das, stimmt, hast, ja, richtig, was das in Frage gestellt hat, führt letzten Endes dazu, dass diese nicht regulierte Behörde macht, was sie will. Deswegen hat David eben auch darauf hingewiesen, dass seine Organisation überprüft, die Patente überprüft hat, hier beim vom Europäischen Patentamt, und dabei festgestellt hat, dass zwischen 20-30% dieser Patente Fälschungen waren. Effektiv functional forgeries, also effektive Fälschungen sind. Ja, ich glaube, wir müssen uns erholen und ein bis zwei Getränke zu uns nehmen.
Well, thank you for the time that you've spent, and I hope that it was helpful.
It was very helpful.
Very helpful. Thank you very much.
We're going to hear a lot of echoes. Thank you, David, and have a great weekend.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Also ich finde, das wirft einen ganz neuen Blick auf die Sachen. Wir gucken uns das jetzt nochmal alles genauer an.
Das müssen wir genau angucken. Martin wird sicherlich auch nochmal genau reingucken.
Sind wir noch online, Fragezeichen?
Nein, wir müssen uns wir müssen uns erst nochmal kurz verabschieden jetzt.
Genau, das werden wir jetzt tun. Also, das ist ja wieder ganz enorm und ich bin also begeistert, dass wir jetzt möglicherweise hier eben in eine ganz neue Richtung gestoßen worden sind nochmal, weil da hängt ja auch einiges von dran an dieser Definition von neu. Ist das nicht so, dass das bei dieser WHO-Definition auch eine Rolle spielt, dass es da sich um ein neuartiges Virus handeln muss? Also wenn es das nicht ist, haben wir überhaupt auch...
Obwohl man es inzwischen ja schon relativiert hat. Man spricht jetzt ja von den Wellen, man spricht jetzt ja von den pandemischen und im postpandemischen Stadium, wie das bei Wellen so ist. Die nächste kommt bestimmt. Also man definiert das gar nicht mehr richtig. Und man geht ja auch nicht davon aus, wie viele gefährliche Erkrankungen es gibt oder Todesfälle, sondern man sagt, da kommen immer neue Viren. Und das ist eine Sache, wo das Immunsystem eben, die das Immunsystem noch nicht kennt. Und deshalb muss man impfen. Und dann sagt man ja auch, dass man diese Welle nur gedämpft kriegt, wenn man dass man die Herdenimmunität nur herstellen kann, wenn man impft. Das ist ein reines Narrativ, was mit Medizin, Biologie, Epidemiologie nichts zu tun hat. Das ist ein Geschäftsmodell, was man uns aufschwatzt. Ja, das macht die WHO.
Was aber nicht nur ein Geschäftsmodell ist, sondern wie er ausdrücklich gesagt hat, das Ganze ist ja als Biowaffe zwischenzeitlich konzipiert gewesen. Das heißt, wir werden hier, so wie wir es immer befürchtet haben, nicht wir, aber die anderen, denen wird hier ein hochgiftiger Stoff injiziert und das erklärt auch die vielen sogenannten Adverse Reactions. Wir haben neue Informationen, denen müssen wir aber erst noch nachgehen, wonach erstaunlicherweise ja, ich weiß nicht mehr, wie viele Prozent der Bevölkerung die erste Impfung bekommen haben. Relativ viel, ich glaube 50 oder sowas oder ein bisschen mehr. Aber vergleichsweise wenig die zweite. Und die Information, denen wir nachgehen müssen, ist, dass sie nicht alle plötzlich Angst gekriegt haben, sondern verstorben sind. Nicht alle, aber etliche.
Ich muss auch noch mal eine Sache erwähnen. Ich habe ja hier schon mal befürchtet, dass wir eben unterschiedliche Dinge im Impfstoff haben. Und dass wir gar nicht genau wissen, dass wir die Sequenzen nicht kennen, dass wir nicht wissen, welche Substanzen uns hier injiziert werden und dass das nicht unbedingt die sind, die einmal irgendwo festgehalten worden sind. Und das, was wir jetzt heute gehört haben, das bestätigt das eigentlich. Ja. Ich sage es deshalb, weil Herr Cicucek, ich weiß nicht mehr, wie er sich ausspricht, der Chef des Paul-Ehrlich-Instituts, der hat in den Staatsmedien hat er verkündet, dass ich also die Unwahrheit sage, dass das also gar nicht stimmen kann. Und er hat dann verkündet, dass da ja sehr viele Kontrollen stattfindet, die ja von den Firmen gemacht werden müssen. Das heißt, die Firmen kontrollieren das selbst. und dann das muss ja sequenziert werden, was da drin ist.
Ja.
Und das geschieht eben nicht. Und er sagt ja, der Standard fehlt völlig. Es fehlt der Standard, woran man dieses Konstrukt, dieses Virus, dieses Wuhan-Virus, dieses, ja, woran man es überhaupt erkennen könnte. Das ist ein Computer, eine Computersequenz. Und da kann man bestimmte Abschnitte rausgreifen. Und was da sequenziert wird, das kann eben sehr, sehr unterschiedlich sein. Und der Standard bei den Impfstoffen, der jetzt, die Impfstoffe, die dazu führen sollen, dass diese künstliche, dieses Protein gebildet wird, welches es in der Natur so nicht vorkommt, sondern welches so ähnlich ist wie ein Spike-Protein, aber ein bisschen anders. Das sind Dinge, die sind so widersprüchlich und sind so, auch in der Information, die wir kriegen, ist so vielfältig, dass man das nicht wirklich kontrollieren kann. Und deshalb kann man schon gar nicht kontrollieren, was in dem Impfstoff drin ist, und wenn man nicht mal weiß, was ganz genau drin sein sollte. Also es ist ein sehr schwieriges Feld. Es ist intransparent, aber wir haben gehört, dass es eine sehr gefährliche Substanz ist, die uns da injiziert werden soll. Man kann da eben nur vorwarnen.
Vielleicht darf ich noch was ergänzen. Ich habe das Dossier von David Martin nicht gesehen, ich habe es auch nicht geprüft. Muss ich also dazu sagen. Bevor ich mich also selber zu irgendwelchen Behauptungen versteige, dass das alles einem Drehbuch folgt, das schon vor 20 Jahren begonnen wurde zu schreiben, werde ich mich also selber da nochmal reinlesen müssen. Ja, das zu betonen ist mir deswegen wichtig, weil es eine Frage der persönlichen Glaubwürdigkeit ist. Ich habe letztens wieder in Mönchengladbach gesagt, auf einer Rede, dass ich nichts glaube, was ich nicht selber überprüft habe, weder von der einen noch der anderen Seite. Und das ist eben die Schwierigkeit. Wir müssen uns möglicherweise der Vorstellung öffnen, dass wir es mit weltweiter Korruption zu tun haben, denn am Ende des Tages, wenn es heißt, it's all about money, dann haben wir es ja nichts anderes als mit einer Allianz von Macht und Geld zu tun. Aber bevor ich mit solchen Behauptungen in die Welt gehe, wäre ich dankbar, wenn ich dieses Dossier selber erstmal lesen könnte. Ich glaube, es ist mir jetzt kurzfristig nochmal zugeschickt worden, aber ich hatte nicht die Zeit, es zu prüfen. Deswegen war ich auch in der Diskussion etwas zurückhaltender und werde es weiterhin sein, bis ich es gelesen habe.
36 Seiten oder sowas, aber es gibt noch viel mehr. Aber diese 36 Seiten, davon gibt es sogar schon eine Zusammenfassung, hat einer unserer Helfer mir vorhin geschickt. Die sind, glaube ich, ganz gut verständlich. Es gibt viel, viel mehr. Ich habe das ganze Zeug, weil das zu viel ist und auch zu viel Technik, die ich nicht verstehen kann, habe das ganze Zeug bei mir gespeichert. Also wenn du mehr brauchst, kriegst es. Aber dieses Dossier ist erstmal meiner Ansicht nach sehr informativ.
Also wir werden es jetzt natürlich auch nochmal durch die entsprechenden Wissenschaftler jagen, wollte ich gerade sagen. Also ich meine, dass wir das die auch nochmal angucken lassen, weil letztlich können wir ja vielleicht die rechtliche Seite beurteilen, aber natürlich nicht die Details von dieser ganzen Sequenziererei. Das heißt, das müssen nochmal Spezialisten angucken.
Also ich denke, dass die Daten, wann Patente angemeldet wurden und was sie beinhalten, dass das ziemlich harte Daten sind und harte Dokumente sind, auf die sich ja auch in der Wirtschaft jeder dann beziehen muss, wenn er irgendwas machen will. Von daher habe ich wenig Zweifel daran, dass man das da feststellen kann, was rechtsgültig ist und was geschehen ist und dass man das gut nachvollziehen kann. Also da eine Story zu machen, die nicht nachprüfbar wäre, das ist schwieriger als im Gebiet der Naturwissenschaften.
Wir gucken es an und dann werden wir entsprechend was veröffentlichen, ob wir das alles so bestätigt gefunden haben. Also es wäre faszinierend, wenn es so wäre. Wir haben also eine kleine Aufgabe übers Wochenende und die nächste Woche. Naja, also ja, wir sind am Ende der Sitzung, würde ich sagen, heute sehr aufregend. Und auch am Ende, ich weiß nicht, Zuschauer vielleicht auch, also wollte nochmal erwähnen, wir freuen uns über Spenden für die Arbeit und auch Open Media freuen sich über Spenden für die Übertragung hier. Und wir kommen dazu, dass wir allen einen ersprießlichen Freitagabend und ein erfreuliches Wochenende wünschen.
Ja.
Bis nächste Woche dann.
Schönes Wochenende.
Tschüss.
Tschüss.
Gleichfalls. Tschüss.